considering the return to Judea by those captives who went into captivity in Babylon, and then taking a look at that early restored Judean community to consider some of the problems they had early on. In this connection, we will consider in a separate lecture the chronology of Ezra chapter 4, which again is one of those chapters which requires some historical understanding if you're to understand the chapter. Because it's, those of you that had the first semester class are aware, there are a number of chapters or sections of chapters in the Bible that are not in chronological order. And you have to do some backing up, you see. We saw that in the case of 1 Samuel. Chapters 28, 29, and 30 are not in strictly chronological order. You have to do some chopping and rearranging to put it back in chronological order. And sometimes in other places, there are places where the story flow goes up to a certain point, and then suddenly you find you're back at a pre-existing set of conditions with a little more detail added, and then you jump back to where the break was and continue on. And so Ezra chapter 4 is one of those chapters, and we'll have to spend some time working with that, coming to understand that more fully. Then what we will do is put together, as best we can do today, a chronological, and that's why I call it reconstruction, of what happened in the return to Judea, starting with Cyrus's decree, allowing it, and ending up with just prior, let's say, the completion of the temple, because we'll try to put that together in a way that we can understand that. We'll next consider the very important work of Ezra, which was primarily a spiritual reconstruction for Judea. We'll also take up the topic of the oral law, because even among many of you, I think there is a false understanding of this term oral law. Now, many of us are familiar with the term oral law as it was understood in the time of Jesus, but I think there is still some confusion about how much of it was man's law and how much of it was God's. And we need to get that squared away. Because I think one of the things you will find out is that the oral law was not totally an invention of the Pharisees. The oral law began with Moses and continued on throughout the Old Testament period in development, having additions made to it all the time. We'll also talk about the impact of Ezra's spiritual reconstruction and how he sort of helped things set into a mold that would keep the Jewish people faithful at least to certain things from his time forward. Then we'll consider the work of Nehemiah in accomplishing the political reconstruction of Judea. And then spend two sessions discussing the chronological problems and trying to relate the work of Ezra and Nehemiah together. And there are many, many different approaches used by scholars as trying to understand the order of these two men. Some say Ezra came first, then Nehemiah. Some say Nehemiah came first, and then Ezra. Some say they narrowly overlapped. Some say they never were there at the same time. There are all kinds of approaches, and we'll use the biblical evidence, of course, as primary, with subsidiary archaeological and other evidence to see what we can come up with in reconstructing the work of these two men. After having had your exam, I'll give you a holiday on the following Monday so you can recuperate. And then we'll get into the Hellenistic period, looking at it first politically and then getting into the book of Daniel. And you might say, well, wait a minute, that's kind of a funny place to put the book of Daniel. Daniel lived at the time of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar and the early Persian rulers. Why are we putting the book of Daniel into the Hellenistic period instead of putting it in the Persian period? Well, because that's where modern critical scholars would put it. Is that the conclusion of modern critical scholars is the book of Daniel was a pious fraud. It wasn't written by anybody living in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. It was written by somebody living at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the persecutions of Antiochus Epiphanes, made to look like a book written earlier for the purpose of strengthening the resistance of the Jews to having their religion destroyed, encouraging them to hang on to their religious traditions by telling a story in part of Daniel's faithfulness and his friend's faithfulness and God's deliverance of them, and that this is all part of a prophetic plan and so on. And so we will begin by looking at what has appeared in print as far as criticisms of the book of Daniel that would place it as a Hellenistic book in terms of its date, and then we will consider it from the traditional views. And I, as you will notice, if you hold your place here and look for a minute at the reading assignments, the reading assignment for March 3rd, you have a number of scriptures from the book of Daniel. And what I'll be asking you to do is to go to the library and look up those scriptures in some modern critical commentaries. Now, you don't have to use more than one. I'll give you a list of three major modern critical commentaries. You go over there and you pick out one, and you look up and see what comments they make about those particular scriptures. And then what you'll do is you'll look at the same scriptures in a traditional or conservative commentary, so you get an idea of the difference of opinion. And that will give you the background for the discussions that we'll have in class, and my lecture material that we'll have in class. Because we have a slightly longer semester this semester than last year, I'm able to put in this next lecture on the identity of Darius the Mede, and notice I cautiously label that a theory, my pet theory. Not that I originated it. No, I can't take credit for that. But I've done a lot of research into it, and this is what, to me, seems to make the most sense at the moment. I don't know if Mr. Kaplan would agree. Now, actuality, how many of you were in a class where he presented his idea of Cyaxares II? Well, he no longer holds that. It's not been proven it can't be Cyaxares II. He's not yet convinced it is my candidate either, but that one has washed out. I don't take any joy in that. We all take our positions on what we think is right. I've been proven wrong as much as I think he has, and maybe more. I don't know. Maybe more. I think more. I tend to make more bold statements. Greater risk, see? But I, as you will note, I will always try to make emphatically clear when I am giving you my private opinion, so that you're aware that in that material, at least, I am not representing what the church officially teaches, so that you can make a clear distinction, you see, and therefore not make any confusion between that, those two types of material. Okay, after we complete that section with an exam, since by now you're more used to the tests, you won't have quite the need for recuperation, we continue right away with the period of the Hasmonean state. The term Hasmonean is simply an alternative term for the family of the Maccabees, which lifted, with God's help of course, the oppression of Antiochus Epiphanes and his successors. We'll then spend at least one lecture dealing with Herod the Great, a truly fascinating individual. I use the word fascinating because that's a neutral term. Augustus, the Emperor Augustus, made two comments, at least that are recorded for posterity, about Herod the Great. In one of his comments, he said, "He is the best client king in my entire empire," which was quite a tribute coming from Augustus, who was a political genius of the highest order. And his second comment was a lot more negative. He said that he would rather be one of Herod's pigs than one of his sons. And if that's perplexing to you, you'll understand it when we study more about Herod the Great. What we'll do on March 24th, assuming we are able to stay to this timetable, is to examine the condition of Judea, politically speaking, in the time of Jesus, to understand more fully what powers the Roman governor had, and how he was working with the local Jewish leadership in ruling the country. Because it's a key to understanding why the Jewish leaders did certain things in connection with Jesus. And it's also important in understanding why Jesus was tried by Pilate at all. So we need to understand more fully exactly what was going on in that particular time period politically. After the next exam, it may seem like it comes hard on the heels of the other, but I think we'll have enough material there for an exam. Might have to delay it one session. We'll see how it goes when we go through there. We'll talk about the different sects and parties that existed in the time of Jesus, because it's a lot more complicated than just Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, some of you, I think, have heard me declaim on this subject in Big Sandy. How many have heard me do that? Okay, so this will be by way of review for you. And new for the others. Suffice it to say that the term Pharisees is meaningless in terms of giving us an understanding of what kind of people we're talking about. Because it's like saying Protestant. What does Protestant convey? Well, certainly anything that's not Catholic or Orthodox. But Protestant covers everything from Holy Rollers to High Church Anglicans. And there's a lot of difference in that span, you see. And if any of you have taken comparative religion, I think you know what I mean, because you've probably gone in even greater depth than some of the others. And others of you may just be aware, just from, you know, having had some contact with different Protestant groups in one way or another through friends or relatives, you know, that there's quite a divergence. And that's the case with the Pharisees. You've got a tremendous range of differences of approach to things in the Pharisee community. And we need to get a little bit more information on what the major groups of Pharisees were like. Because sometimes Jesus, in the things he said, was taking issue between two different schools of thought among the Pharisees themselves. You see. And if you don't understand the distinction, you don't understand why he's phrasing his words, you say, the way he did. Because he's setting in opposition a teaching of one school of Pharisees as opposed to the teaching of another school of Pharisees. Of course, I think there are many that misunderstand the position of the Sadducees as well. What do you know about the Sadducees, about their teachings or beliefs? Who wants to drop into my net? Who's got a strong ego strength, in other words? Dan, we... Well, there I would agree with you. They didn't believe in the resurrection. Okay. That was a good comment. The others now are more cautious. Mike? Okay. But let's talk about the religious teachings. What else did they not believe in? Bill? Shouldn't have called you from Big Sandy. Yeah. See, most people feel that they didn't believe in angels. That's not true. They did believe in angels. But they didn't believe in guardian angels, which was a major popular teaching of the Pharisees. You see. Now, you may say, well, wait a minute. I think the scripture says they didn't believe in angels. Well, that's because writing for the audience of that day, it wasn't necessary to specify what kind of angels they didn't believe in. They could just write that brief statement. But they did believe in angels. It was guardian angels. And there was a third major distinction between them, of course, and the Pharisees, which is commonly misunderstood too. It's not that they didn't believe in the oral law, where the Pharisees did. They just didn't believe it was as binding as the written law. And therefore, you know, you could maybe get some general guidance from it, but you didn't have to follow it. The Pharisees, of course, said you had to follow the oral law as rigorously as you followed the written law. The two were of equal binding force. One of the things we'll note as we go through the Jesus and the religious teachings of his age is that one of the big problems of that day was a matter, to use New Testament phraseology, of binding and loosing, and how one was to do it, what one should be binding and what one should be loosing, and when one should do this and when one should do that. And the Pharisees of one school had their ideas, the Pharisees of another school had their ideas, the Sadducees had their ideas, and Jesus, of course, was coming among them saying, you're right here, but you're wrong there, and you're over here, you're right here, but then you're wrong here. Because each of them had a little bit of the truth in the right approach and the right decisions, but nobody had it all right. And Jesus, of course, was trying to set them straight on how to go about this very difficult process of binding and loosing. As you can see, we will spend three sessions on the arrest and trial of Jesus. You'll get a special handout for that. And I think that's what it shows here, yes. Yeah. I used to have people use their Harmony of the Gospels. But that got to be cumbersome because many times people said they wanted to make notes and then they found they had notes already there from First Year Bible and there wasn't space. So it's just easier. What I did is using Harmony. Using the Harmony, I just Xeroxed out the passages in particular we need to focus on. That way you can make whatever notes you want right on the handout, and it will come to you hole punched, so if you wish to preserve it, you can, for some future reference. We'll spend a session sort of digesting everything we've learned about Judea in the time of Jesus, and then go into our fourth exam, and then cover the period from the death of Jesus through the period of the early church, through the end of Paul's ministry, essentially, and also take some time to note the growing conflict that began between organized Judaism and organized Christianity, and the reasons that lay behind that. And so that will bring us to the end of the semester. Now, what I'd like you to do for next time, you'll notice under the reading assignments, you do have an assignment for next time. You have to read in the textbook the pages 8 through 15. This will give you a general background on the early Persian period. It will give you some familiarity with the early rulers. You may want to take a look at some of the specific scriptural references that are mentioned in the textbook to sort of see why they're bringing them into the account. And it will sort of give you a sort of an overview of what was going on, you know, in this period. So then you have a sort of a background for us discussing it in more detail. Then in the Bible, if you will read chapters 1 and 2, by reason of just becoming more familiar with the contents. And also, you might want to make notes of anything that you find surprising to find in those chapters, or confusing, or otherwise unexpected, and because we will be discussing a few of those things that are present there. Generally, what I've tried to do is give you the scriptural assignments I would like you to at least review in advance of the lecture so that you know the content. You're not getting it first when we go over it, so that you can focus more on my interpretation of those scriptures rather than, you know, just coming to grips with what the scriptures say. Now, you'll notice also that for January 27th, you're supposed to consult a chart of Persian kings. And although there is one in the textbook, I have prepared a number of chronologies. One of them is sort of a bird's eye view of historical periods in Palestine for this semester's material, showing you the generally used dates for breaking down the Persian period, Hellenistic period, Roman period, Byzantine, Arabic, and Turkish. Now, we're not going to go that far, but I thought I might as well carry it through so you are familiar with it. And then we have sort of a general chronology of the post-exilic period from 539 down to the end of the Persian period when Alexander conquers the Persian Empire. So it has the key events in terms of Judea, the key Persian rulers, and, of course, the dates for the Persian rulers. Then there are some important dates in the intertestamental period, which is beginning with Alexander down to the time Herod the Great takes Judea, sort of giving you an overview there. And then you have a chronology for the period of the Maccabees, the Maccabean rulers, and their dates of reign, because that will become important in the lectures we deal with them. And then a listing of some of the rulers of Palestine in the time of Christ and Paul, starting with Caesar Augustus, who was the ruler when Christ was born, Tiberius, Herod the Great, Herod Antipas, and I'm surprising, but I find a number of people still don't know the difference between Herod Antipas and Herod the Great. So we need to sort of straighten that out. Herod Agrippa, the second. I'm not putting in Herod Agrippa the first. I don't know why I left him out. I did, am I? the Herod Agrippa who's mentioned, well, the Agrippa who's mentioned in the book of Acts, is Herod Agrippa the first. Herod Agrippa the second is a later ruler. And then the Roman procurators that were ruling Palestine, beginning with Pontius Pilate, and then, of course, I've skipped some, Felix and Festus, because these are the ones that specifically mention in the New Testament. And I think that does it for that. So this chart of the Persian kings, you can use this one that's on page 2, or you can use the one that's in the textbook, whichever you find more convenient. So let me distribute these. Being distributed, that one of the reasons for giving this particular class is that most of us, we read the Old Testament, and we carry through down to the days of the last prophets, at least chronologically speaking, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. And then we turn the page, and we begin with Matthew's Gospel. And we leap over centuries. And yet the world of the Gospels, politically, and even more importantly, religiously speaking, is so totally different from the world of the last prophets. For example, the key figure in the last books of the Old Testament, speaking chronologically, is, of course, the prophet. But prophets play almost a minor role in the New Testament books. And in the Jewish religious establishment, the prophet is not even a figure at all. The high priest is the big figure in the Jewish religious establishment. And although, of course, the high priest is an office that goes back all the way to the time of Mount Sinai, when God gave instructions to Moses that Aaron, Moses' brother, should be ordained to that office, he was never such a leading figure. He never played a leading role above that of the prophet or even the king in Jewish affairs. And suddenly, at the time of Jesus, it's the high priest who's everything. Now, how did the high priest's office go through this transformation? This is what we want to see in this intertestamental period. What are the reasons why the high priest's office goes through this important transformation? Where and why did these groups known as Pharisees and Sadducees originate? What is it that called those groups into being? As well as, of course, what were the fundamental differences in their approaches and their beliefs, so we can better understand how Jesus interrelated with them. And, of course, the early New Testament books, the Gospels, deal with a setting which the Roman government is firmly in charge and ruling Judea in a certain fashion. And what we need to understand is how the Romans got there, why they got there, why they were ruling Judea the way they were ruling it. All these things need to be learned and appreciated. And so there are a number of themes that we'll be developing and we'll be building onto as we go through the semester, as we try to see how it all comes to create the set of conditions that exist in the time of Jesus. And so that's the primary reason why it was thought useful to have a class that covered this particular material. Okay, I've pretty much finished what I have to say. Is there anyone that has any questions that they... Oh, I wanted to make some comment about this textbook. In line with what I just finished saying, you can better understand the title in full of this textbook, which is not just the New Testament era. Focus on that. The New Testament era. The world of the Bible from 500 B.C. to 100 A.D. And you might say, well, wait a minute, 500 B.C.? What has that got to do with the New Testament era? 500 years about, well, more than 500 years before Christ began his ministry. But you see, if you don't understand what was going on in this period, forming the political and the religious mentality and expectations of the people, you can't understand why so many times the people had trouble comprehending Jesus and comprehending his message. Even his own disciples did not understand his message. How many times did he talk about his need to die and be resurrected? Several times. They never got it. So much so that when he died, they were sure it was all over. And when Mary Magdalene and the other women reported having seen the resurrected Jesus, they didn't believe him. Because there was nothing in their religious education that told them the Messiah would die and be resurrected. We used to have an article. We don't print it anymore. I'm not sure exactly the reason why not. It was an excellent article. Maybe it's a bit too strong. Maybe that was the problem with it. And it had a very good title. I don't think I'll write it. It said, Jews reject Jesus, Christians reject Christ. In other words, the Jews today are blind to the idea that the Messiah... Now, religious Jews do not deny that there's going to be a Messiah. It's a very important part of their faith. But they deny that the Messiah will have to die and be resurrected. It's not part of their teaching. It's also not part of their teaching that he's going to be God in the flesh, you see. And so Jews, because of what they understand about Messiah, reject Jesus as being the one. While today, many Christians focus so heavily upon Jesus as the one who came to die and then go to heaven after being resurrection, that they ignore all the prophecies about his return. Now, of course, your fundamentalist groups are very heavily focusing now, again, about the millennium and his return. But many mainline Protestants just regard that as, well, a carryover of Jewish religious thinking, and that's, you know, really not going to happen. That's sort of a semi-mythical event. And so they reject Christ, the returning, conquering king, while the Jews are deceived by rejecting the suffering Messiah. And as I say, there were a lot of misunderstandings that the Jews had. And, as I say, these misunderstandings developed in this very important bridge period we call the intertestamental period. Okay, we'll let you go. We'll see you next time.